Now, next point that you should know, and I agree, I read your, is that it's not only Kant against Hegel. The gap is already in Kant himself. Kant is a much more, you know, almost it sounds sometimes when you read these naive Enlightenment guys as if Kant was still a good guy, clear, benevolent, Enlightenment, and then this crazy, dark, obscure metaphysician, Schelling, Hegel, Kant. No, no, with Kant already, but I don't have time to do this, of course, today. Things are much more complex. Another example.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, we discuss Zizek's book, The Indivisible Remainder, which discusses primarily the German idealist philosopher Schelling. Before we get started, I should note that Donald is on hiatus for a bit, because he's simply too busy to be participating in the podcast regularly at this time, so we may have several more episodes without him. You just heard a clip of Zizek giving a talk on Is Hegel Dead? Right now you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but in a second you'll hear us discuss particulars, universals, the nature of evil, and the state.
I have some like notes on Schelling as a person, and considering that this book is ostensibly all on Schelling and related matters, it'd be good to have an idea of who this guy is.
Yeah, like I was saying before we start recording, all I really knew about Schelling is that he's also a German idealist, knew Hegel and became a rival of Hegel, and is generally associated with being kind of the most romantic or maybe explicitly kind of theological of them, makes a lot of kind of metaphysical appeals, even more so than some of the others.
Yeah, I mean, it is, his story seems to be like, you know, a breakup of a friendship that, you know, Lenda turned into a rivalry because he was...
They were roommates or something?
Yeah, it was, and they were roommates. Schelling was, roommates with Hegel and Hödel at Tübingen. And then something must have happened and they sort of became rivals about, you know, their interpretations of like post Kantian philosophy. And Schelling is a lot more difficult to his work is much more difficult to summarize because very fragmentary, and also he seems to change his mind not only between texts but also between different drafts of the same text. And the common interpretation of Schelling is that he is this transitory figure between the subjective idealism of Fichte, who reduced all of experience to the absolute ego, and the absolute idealism of Hegel, who brought in this sort of dialectical negativity to explain being and thinking as a unity in difference. And this is a reading of Schelling that derives from Hegel's own history of philosophy, which of course portrays Hegel as, you know, the most complete figure of German idealism, as someone who's sort of solved the issue of philosophy. And so Zizek challenges this sort of common reading of Schelling in The Indivisible Remainder, and, you know, points out that, you know, Schelling was still writing 20 years after Hegel's death, and that we can see Schelling as a transitory figure between, you know, German idealism and materialism in some ways, this sort of proto-materialist thinker, because of the ways that he conceives of the relationship between freedom and necessity, or how freedom emerges out of a kind of a primordial moment.
What's also difficult about this book in particular is that, I mean, one, it's hard to read because it's three chapters and each chapter is 100 pages long, almost exactly. But also that, like, part one is the the chapter where he mostly engages with Schelling directly and basically provides an exegesis on Schelling, making that argument that you were bringing out, particularly by trying to look at the different drafts he has of his work on, I can't remember what it's usually translated to, but the
Ages of the World. Yeah. Ages of the World. Yeah.
And he is particularly interested in Schelling's conception of contraction in relation to freedom and grounding. But after that, like, in typical Zizek fashion, his claim to be talking about Schelling mostly becomes a way to talk about all these other more contemporary kind of debates about, like, you know, his favorites like Lacan, or he talks about like Derrida and Foucault and all this stuff about conceiving of like language and subjectivity and the big other, and he'll throw in Schelling with it, but it's not like directly using Schelling as this kind of guiding thread as much as he might claim.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a strange book because Schelling is not one of those thinkers that you'd ordinarily associate with Žižek. Everyone's sort of more familiar with like him being really into Hegel, into Lacan, into Freud, into Marx. And so it does seem like the following two chapters after this sort of Schelling-heavy chapter is just sort of a return to routine for Žižek, because the second chapter is really about Hegel and Lacan, and the third chapter is just about Lacan. And in the third chapter, you know, you just see some of the greatest hits that he often brings up in his other works about courtly love, how, you know, we need obstacles to actually to actually have a relationship with the other, and that how cyberspace is narcissistic and virtual reality shouldn't be opposed to like the real world. It should be able to show us that reality is all virtual. And also he has some other points about quantum physics. So the first chapter is this very dense reading of Schelling, because he is obsessed with that moment of beginning. Like, what happened before the beginning, or what does the beginning represent? Like, how does being itself come into consciousness and language? And for Schelling, like, he uses this very theological language of like the creation of God, or like the God's self-positing as a subject through the word, which creates a rupture in time between the rotary motion of the drives, like a cyclical time of nature, and the emergence of a kind of linear temporal history, which is the time of culture. Yet what this does is produce a problem of like what came before that rupture. Like, and Žižek sees an analogy here between like the split between the symbolic and the real from Lacan, or the conscious and the unconscious. Like, so it's very similar to those primordial events in Freud and Lacan, where for Freud there's that Oedipal complex where the subject, you know, comes to, you know, be integrated into the authority of the father, and has to suppress certain drives and desires that become a subject. And for Lacan, there's the mirror stage where the baby or the child, you know, sees their image and you know, starts to be more integrated into the symbolic order of the father. And these are, you know, these are mythical narratives, but they are attempts to grapple with that point of the split between freedom and necessity. But what Schelling shows is that every way that we have of understanding that split is retroactive, or, you know, just mythical. It's very difficult to understand within our own frameworks that moment of of the origin of the moment of that split.
Given what you mentioned about how Zizek is not often associated with Schelling, interestingly, I have heard people accuse Zizek, basically saying that how he talks about Hegel is really more Schellingian in general, but most people don't know enough about the kind of focuses to catch him on it. I was hoping this book would maybe help me understand enough, but I also haven't read that much of like Zizek's more Hegel specific work to like really know, and it's just so dense. It was a bit like when you're reading a novel where it's like, you know, every 10 pages you're like, oh, something interesting is happening, and then 50 pages in you realize you haven't like actually kept up on what all those events were. Because you kind of go, wait a minute, what was happening a while ago? Like this thing I'm reading right now is kind of interesting, but I don't actually remember how we got here. I did remember thinking in terms of how he like talks about Schelling's attempt to kind of elaborate on the totality and the specific with existence and ground, the way that he tries to elaborate on Schelling's discussion of evil. And this idea of, like, he kind of tries to relate it to this idea of like the tendency to treat evil as this like particular thing that attacks the universal state, but instead says that evil is, he always uses the term short circuit, but he says it's a short circuit where like it's the claim to represent the universal through a particular expression on its own. So like, you know, I mean, he's obviously trying to kind of like relate this political rhetoric of saying that, you know, I speak on behalf of the state or whatever, that my particularity expresses the whole four ends that I give. And he says like that there's this idea of kind of degrading the universal by taking it into my own particularity and kind of having a tautological relationship to the universal, where I presuppose what the universal demands, but then justify it as that I am expressing it through my own presupposition as a particular within it.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how Zizek is able to extract the political ramifications of Schelling's thought. And it seems that Schelling's comments on evil for Zizek have a relationship, can be like related to a critique of the state, but not in a sense that the state is this entity that completely, you know, represses our individual wills or desires, and you know, must be overthrown, or that the state is this realization of reason, as Hegel would suggest. Zizek suggests that the state for Schelling is this false unity that does claim to speak in the name of the universal through a, you know, particular manner, through the, you know, the party who's ruling the state, or a ruling class of a state, because it does suppress or repress the essential and antagonism or split that that underpins the state. And so for Schelling, the state is never like an authentic form of social unity, and it would be evil to suggest as such or to speak in that manner. But at the same time, it's not a totally anti-statist politics, because there would be for Schelling, or Zizek's reading of Schelling, that there is the possibility of forming a state where you could accept this order as known. I mean, there is this complicated relationship between the evil and the state in what Zizek sees in the Schelling. And that comes and goes. It'd be interesting to sort of dig into that more, I think.
I know that he talked about it, and he talks about kind of how Schelling is a bit ambiguous on his relationship to, you know, the state, the German state of his, the Prussian state of his time. It's just like, it's just spread out throughout the piece, so I can't really, like, remember where he kind of digs into it more directly.
And it has to do with, like, Žižek's emphasis on the second draft of The Ages of the World. Like, for something for him is, like, very unresolved about the first draft, but in the third draft there is something more reactionary about Schelling's thoughts. So the most, you know, fecund part of Schelling's work is in the second draft of the text.
Yeah, okay, so the index, it says the three stages of thought in politics, 39-42. So maybe that's where I need to look. Yeah, maybe it's under the section subtitled Schellingian Politics.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah.
It draws on Habermas, actually, to kind of periodize Schelling, though it's not just the three drafts of the one piece. He's also kind of just periodizing him through his work as a whole, because he says that, you know, earlier Schelling is more of a classical bourgeois thinker who sees the modern state, and I'm quoting here, who conceives the modern state and the legal order guaranteed by it as the only possible framework of human freedom. Far from constraining freedom, the legal order provides its only foundation, since without the rule of law, freedom inevitably degenerates into despotic self-will. In clear contrast, the late Schelling of positive philosophy is effectively reactionary. He fully acknowledges the repressive character of state power, that is, the irreducible and constitutive antagonism between the state and its subjects. He is fully aware of how state power, in the end, always runs counter to the freedom of its subjects, how it remains forever a foreign power which exerts pressure on subjects, how subjects will never truly internalize state power and experience it as their own, as an expression of their own innermost will. In short, to put it in traditional Marxist terms, Schelling fully acknowledges the alienated character of the state. He then says, though, that Schelling is thoroughly in favor of the state and of the inviolable, unconditional character of its authority, because man is a sinful being. And then, yeah, but he kind of sees middle Schelling as being like the revolutionary one, because the state is alienated, but evil in that it tries to transform itself into a universal that is actually, in fact, particular.
And it also, I mean, I think represses the originary act of violence that goes into forming the state. I think that there is this need for like active forgetting of the origin of the state itself as a particular entity in order to posit itself as universal.
Yeah, the kind of like hidden arbitrariness almost in a way, or like the, like, I mean, this is something that definitely shows up in a lot of the kind of French social theories. Yeah, like the, for something to pronounce what it is, it needs to also in effect like hide its pronouncement. Like it can't acknowledge itself as an act emergent from something like more primordial to itself. Because he talks about, like, in Schelling, the act of violence that is, I don't know, it's hard to talk about it because I can't necessarily like keep track of all the specific terminological language that is used for everything, but the kind of idea of like reason as an act of violence or ordering as an act of violence that actually throws out, you know, he uses some like Hamlet references, throws out of joint the actual constitution of things grounded in disorder. But at the same time, this act of violence, of order, it's not that it's merely hiding the true disorder of the state of affairs. It's rather that the order, the establishing of order, obfuscates its own creation or foundation within the state of disorder.
I think, yeah, and I think that this comes back to what he says, what he puts forward as the central question of the book. Although in the introduction, he does say that there are like several central questions of the book, so I don't know how that works. But one of the questions is, he writes, perhaps the moment has come to leave behind the old leftist obsession with ways and means to subvert or undermine the order, and focus on the opposite question, not how we can undermine the existing order, but how does an order emerge out of disorder in the first place, which inconsistencies and splittings allow the edifice of order to maintain itself. A weird slip there, but largely because I'm thinking about Schelling's thoughts on, you know, the emotions of God, and like how it's, Zizek describes it as like in that moment God has to sort of shit out the drives or shit out a certain shit out something from himself in order to establish that moment of constitution, that emerging of the subject, which is analogous to how, you know, order comes out of disorder itself. It's, there is a way of trying to like expel the disorder that is still a part of the subject itself, and then emerges through, well, if we were being psychoanalytic about it, emerges through symptoms that point to the inconsistencies and splittings that aren't opposites to order, but allow the order to function, even if they are contradictions.
I think the theological language that is obviously built into Schelling, but that, I don't know, like, I was kind of surprised the extent to which, like, Zizek really just doubles down on being like, yeah, so if God does this, and I know that his, like, out is that it's actually, you know, a psychoanalytical reading, but I kind of feel like it maybe points to some of the problems of the way that Zizek frames a lot of his work, or that there is kind of, like, this implicit that kind of like, oh, I'm really just like a material theologian. There's a kind of like spiritualism that we need to talk about the material, you know, like, because I found it a little bit hard to actually kind of draw out. I mean, obviously you can take, yeah, this stuff about God and the establishment of the universe and order and disorder as this kind of more general statement about particularity and universalism. But I don't know, it was one of those things that made me feel a little bit like, yeah, this is where I see some people get a bit suspicious of how Zizek talks and frames his kind of magpie cherry picking of certain things, and the way in particular that he frames his whole, like, reason is foregrounded and important because it's actually not totalizing, and it kind of seems to have this weird, almost theological aspect to it.
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing a little bit of reading, as you know, sometimes I do, I came across, there was an exchange of articles between Zizek and Peter Dews in the 90s when this book came out. I think the subtitle of the article was just like, and Zizek's misreading of Schelling, and how Zizek was, I think, ignoring the element of like reconciliation within Schelling's thought by positing like an indivisible gap. I mean, we can get onto this when we talk about part two and the vanishing mediator. But Jews' criticism of Žižek's reading of Schelling was ultimately like a critique of Žižek's politics, that there was something like almost covertly nationalistic and reactionary about Žižek's version of Schelling. And I mean, I thought it's like it seems like this exchange took place over several articles, so it'd be interesting to dig into that. But there are like people who are very suspicious of what what Žižek has done to what how Žižek reads Schelling and what that suggests about Žižek's politics generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something in general that Žižek, because he was such a philosophical, he was the Elvis of philosophy during certain periods, that there's just a lot that he writes about and makes these bold statements about, that he's being very like intentional in his use of people, but is often taken to be a clear elaborator of the figures themselves in a way that's kind of problematic if you're trying to make a clear understanding of what, Hegel is about or Schelling is about or something. Like, you're probably actually not going to get necessarily the best reading of them in their own work. You're going to get an elaboration on how to use them for something.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, I'm not enough of, obviously not familiar enough with Schelling, but not enough of Hegelian or Lacanian to really, like, figure out whether his readings are accurate or if they're sort of instrumentalized for, like, a Žižekianism. And there are obviously people who, really do disagree with, like, his readings and think that he's deeply wrong. Not deeply wrong, but, he does, like, have misinterpretations of certain thinkers.
This is making me think that maybe I need to see if there's that one guy, I can't remember his name. There's a particular guy who has a lot of really good work on German idealism in general. Maybe I'll have to see if I can get him on. Because unfortunately, I tried to contact Peter Dues after we did his book, and I just don't think he has like a publicly reachable address anymore. I don't think he really like checks his academic email all that much. Do we want to try and dare to talk about the other sections of the book?
I mean, I'd be more comfortable with talking about part three, because that was the section where my sort of Žižek pattern recognition started to flare up, and you're like, oh, I recognize all of the things that Žižek's talking about from all of the other the stuff he's written. And so I sort of get what's going on there. And I mean, it seems like the central idea of part two is that vanishing mediator issue, which is like where Žižek sees like the failing of Schelling to really reach a reconciliation between nature and cultural freedom and necessity, and that Žižek's interested in trying to get at that gap because it is something that underpins the fantasy of the origin or something like that. But I don't know if you'd want to talk about the vanishing mediator, but I think that's what I got out of it.
Yeah, it's such a long, winding chapter, and it kind of just draws on too much. In a way, the part that I thought was almost the most interesting that I remember just being like, huh, is where he has that bit where he tries to talk about like the term and.
Oh, yeah.
Like the function of and conjoining the particular and the universal, just because it gave me a clear understanding of how Žižek does his weird reconciliation of like Althusser and Hegelian totality. But it was mostly for that more than its contribution to the overall argument about like Schelling. So yeah, we can probably skip two if we want, for the most part. I have increasingly come to be like, I flinch whenever, social theory or something is it decides it's going to talk about how quantum physics tells us something important about the contingency or whatever.
Very Zizekian of like the premise of like that's the, I mean the premise of the chapter is quantum physics with Lacan and like oh well, the psychoanalyst will enable us to sort of understand this, and it reminds me of although it was the entire book was in bad faith that Alan Sokol book Fashionable Nonsense where he really attacks like post-structuralist thinkers for talking about science in their books, and of course most of the time like Sokol doesn't like have any charitable readings, and most of the thinkers are like Baudrillard doesn't understand this certain idea, and so you know the whole framework of his thought is nonsense, despite the fact that, you know, Baudrillard wasn't, you know, making a point about science. He was making a point about, like, he was just using, like, a scientific example as a metaphor. But at the same time, like, if you're going to make a claim about, like, having this sort of understanding of, you know, scientific notions, but you just ultimately reduce them to the thought of, you know, someone else, it's doubtful whether, you know, it's really an interesting thing about science. Or
the thing is that I think it's not in and of itself wrong to want to draw upon points in science as potentially useful metaphors for other things, or to try and talk about how certain developments in science point to limits in how we often frame things, because maybe we've discovered something that escapes the usual framework that would be like intuitive to our normal understanding of something. I'm usually mostly skeptical of people that use scientific frameworks and stuff like that to make a grand proclamation about something. And then if you critique them about, well, this has a problem in terms of you frame the scientific model you're using or whatever is showing this, but it doesn't actually show that, it shows this other thing. And then if they withdraw and they say like, oh, well, you know, I just get to use it in my own fashion. And it's like, well, if you're trying to use it to elaborate on a principle, it actually does matter if you're showing something in a useful way. If you're already misinterpreting something, you might want to have a different use for your metaphor or your thing. Especially the thing that bothers me about it is often is when social theory likes to make a claim that there's a greater need to have, you know, a dialogue with the hard sciences, and that it's an entirely one way, like, I get to use all this hard science stuff to make claims, and if they critique that I'm not using it in a way that shows comprehension of their points, then I get to carve, like, an autonomous space that doesn't need to engage with dialogue anymore. Though I do appreciate, I actually think that this is an aside, but actually, Derrida actually had a pretty decent response to the Sokol hoax, I think, from what I remember. That was kind of, it was actually just kind of a point that he was like, yeah, this might actually have some like important things to say, but it's a bit of a shame that he mostly just walked away after he said it, so we don't get to talk about it more. Like,
yeah.
Needless to say, I am frustrated with the use of quantum physics because it's wibbly wobbly and sounds cool. And I've met enough people who are on the left and do physics that get annoyed with it. But I mean, it is actually not quite as central as the leading title maybe makes it sound.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off with, oddly enough, cyberspace, like, and we've talked about this before, but the there is a sort of quaint pattern in a lot of the books that we've some of the books that we've read in the first two sets of the Radical Thinkers that are usually from the 90s that have all of these things to say about cyberspace or, you know, globalization. It seems sort of like fascinating to look back on that moment. But I think that what's, you know, good about Zizek, or slightly better than Zizek, is that he isn't like, oh, cyberspace is going to ruin like this authentic phenomenological experience, or it's going to distort the distances between us. It is that there is something about virtual reality that exposes the how the reality that we perceive as, you know, immediate or true is already, you know, mediated through the lens of a symbolic that we, you know, don't necessarily have control over already.
It is, double check, because I don't remember. Let's see, so this was published in 1996. I don't know if it was initially, if any of this was initially published separately or in a different language before then.
No, this was, so I've got like the original edition, and it was when Zizek was an editor for Verso of a particular series called Woe Espoir. That's like, that's, it's, I don't know why I pronounced German like it was French, but it's from Freud, and it was based on Freud saying, where it was, I shall come into being, which, you know, is described here as Freud's version of the Enlightenment goal of knowledge that is in itself an act of liberation. But this is, so it was initially published in English under this series that also published the Zizek book that we read in the last set, and also, strangely enough, Bentham's Panopticon writings. So I don't know what's going on there, but
I mean, it is kind of interesting. It does feel like some of the points he makes are maybe, I mean, they're still of their time, but it does feel like he's maybe having a mid-2000s discussion of certain aspects of digital connectivity rather than a like late 90s one.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like good for him. got over like some of the stuff, some of the big, yeah, obsessions a little bit earlier.
Over the Y2Kism of Virilio. That's unfair to Virilio, but you know, there does have that, he does have that sort of element to him. But I mean, I think the most fun parts of these books are always Zizek's books are always the like the brief film interpretations, which I think he is a really good film critic. I think, and the idea of like interpreting, you know, Forrest Gump through the idea of the ideology, and although the film presents, you know, Forrest Gump as this sort of naive, non-ideological figure who doesn't get caught up within these broader political conflicts of his time. He's not truthfully a non-ideological figure. He's actually a pure subject of ideology who operates according to, you know, who makes the ideological nature of, you know, the American state seem like an authentic expression of human nature. And so that was neat. I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, Zizek and films will always be like his best or his most, you know, enjoyable, the most enjoyable element of his work.
Yeah. I mean, I still think my favorite Zizek book is his movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But yeah. It is a good movie, I think. Both of them, like, there's the Astra Taylor Zizek one and also the longer one, like the Pervert's Guide to Cinema or Ideology or whatever it is.
Well, there's Pervert's Guide to Cinema and Pervert's Guide to Ideology.
The first one was a series, right? Or was it a movie?
I think it's a movie, but I think when you find it around today, it's usually cut up into several parts. And it's because it's harder to find, I think. But yeah, Pervert's Guide to Cinema, Pervert's Guide to Ideology is basically a redone kind of like companion to Pervert's Guide to Cinema with a little bit more production value, I guess you might say. Those were the ones that I always liked, like more than his actual writing. But yeah, he still kind of stands out mostly when he's writing stuff like that, rather than now joining a weird post-right journal as a contributing editor.
Yeah, maybe we should, like, yeah. I mean, it's probably not surprising. I mean, I think that there are so many, you know, ways you could take it, and I'd want to go back to that Peter Dew's criticism of Zizek's supposed misreading of Schelling as an indicator of Zizek's more sort of nationalistic or conservative politics, or you know, relationship to the idea of the state, because compact it seems to be like we're, you know, leftists and rightists who really want to go back to like a slightly more reactionary state. And so yeah, maybe there is a connection that we can use to wrap it all up.
Well, I think it's, again, like this kind of relates to the paradox of that Zizek is constantly writing works that are engaging in like deep, long-standing relationships to things like German idealism and then French psychoanalysis and post-structuralism and things, alongside him becoming an English kind of phenomenon because of his writings on the collapse of Yugoslavia. But like the paradox is that he's always taken as kind of an introductory figure, when in fact you often won't know how he's using things without already having some sort of engagement in these debates. Because I also think about there's that book Negative Revolution or something, the John Holloway one on like Adorno and activism, basically.
Okay.
And there's I think it's Negativity and Revolution might be it. And there's a chapter by a guy in there that is kind of associated, I think, with the open Marxism kind of crowd, who is also from former Yugoslavia, might be Slovenia, I don't know which area he's now from, but and he kind of talks about the phenomenon of Zizek being this big popular figure in Anglo-American left-wing philosophy at the time, but he kind of talks about how they don't really understand where Zizek stood and the kinds of political choices that he made in the collapse of Yugoslavia and the political parties that emerged from it. And he kind of critiques that he doesn't think that Zizek is actually tied to thought that would be pretty contradictory to the way that people read him. So I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the criticisms of Zizek in the West often resort down to just like that he doesn't like certain kinds of political correctness and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's actually maybe less mm-hmm. interesting as a direct criticism on their own. Sometimes I think he makes good points. Other times it's like, I think you have to treat it as more symptomatic of like mm-hmm. other aspects of his thought overall and his commitments overall.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. And I think that, I mean, what was the author that you were talking about you know, looking at like where Zizek's thought is coming from, and how it, you know, yeah, how it emerges from certain political commitments is kind of elided by those more sort of simplistic, like Zizek is, you know, against immigrants or something like that, which is usually, you know, but based on, you know, somewhat uncharitable readings of, you know, certain texts about refugees. Or that, you know, he has that sort of like almost tongue-in-cheek, but maybe not tongue-in-cheek, like pot shots at, you know, the sort of liberal multiculturalism, which I think should like be critiqued in itself, because it is a way of framing the relationship to the other that actually flattens the otherness of the other, and has a much more sort of like patronizing approach to, you know, how we relate to people from other cultures or how they should relate to us.
I think the person I'm thinking of, so that, the book is Negativity and Revolution, which is a Pluto Press book. And I think the person I'm thinking of, I'll probably get their name wrong, but it's like Dari Zadnikar. They also teach at University of Ljubljana.
Okay.
I don't think that they have a whole lot else in English, though. Like, I haven't found much else. So I don't think that they're necessarily, like, you're not going to find an academia.edu page with, like, a ton of useful things where that goes into the complexity of Žižek or something.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that might be a good place to leave our discussion of Žižek. And unless you have anything else that you'd like to comment?
No, not necessarily. It's a weird book. I mean, it's probably interesting if you really just like do want to read about Schelling, but you're also probably not going to get the most clear view of Schelling per se just from this book.
Yeah, and when I was looking up this book, I mean, it is branded as Žižek's probably most complicated and least straightforward works, so it's not really a good introduction to Žižek either, unless you are, you know, a diehard like Schelling scholar, a diehard, you know, Žižekian. I don't think that you'd want to like. I don't think that it would raise any sort of raise many interesting points for you. And so our next text is Laclau's
one of utmost contemporary relevance.
Again, yeah. No, but I was leafing through it, and the preface says all of these essays were written and published between 1991 and 1995. It's all basically about that period. So it will be diving back into the 90s again next time with another, you know, post-structuralist thinker.
That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening to this rambling discussion of Schelling and more about Žižek. Our next read will be, as mentioned, the Laclau book, Emancipations. We hope you'll read along with us. You can read the Peter Dews article discussed in the show notes. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll join us next time.